I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Don Farmer. He is a physicist. He is a professor in the Institute of New Economic Thinking at Oxford. He is director of the Complexity Economics Center there, and he is external faculty at the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
So we're going to talk about economics and talk about economics in terms of complex systems. But for our listeners, explain to us what a complex system is and give us some examples.
So the examples are easy because there are so many of them around us. Any biological organism, a brain, the immune system, society, an anthill. Complex systems are systems that do complex things, but where the parts may be quite simple. And the fascination is that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, and that the whole exhibits behaviors, that emergent behaviors, as we would say, that are often very qualitatively different than the behavior of the individual units. So the behavior of a neuron, just from looking at a neuron, it would be hard to imagine what a brain could do. From looking at an individual ant, it would be hard to believe that an anthill would be capable of farming mushrooms and fighting wars and taking slaves and fairly complex behaviors. And similarly, in the economy, the fascination is that we all go about our business. There's some rules that we're supposed to follow, and yet what emerges is much richer than the individual activities of individual people, as was originally noted by Adam Smith in 1776. Somehow, there's this invisible hand that, despite the fact that people are more or less doing things for their own good, there's something emerges that contributes to the common welfare.
Now, one thing that I think is confusing a little bit for me is that when you talk about complex systems like an organism or an ecosystem, you also talk about complex systems like the weather. The weather is inanimate. Complex systems like an anthill are basically animate. They're biological life. Do those things have any underlying principles in common?
Yes
and
no.
And the economy, which is a kind of funny, what is it? Is it a human system like a biological system or not?
Yeah. So in complex systems, we distinguish adaptive complex systems from non-adaptive. So the weather would be an example of something that's not adaptive. I mean, the weather just happens. In ecology, there's adaptation going on in the background. There's selection. Similarly, in the economy, there's selection. The firms that don't produce stuff that people want go out of business. Firms that operate efficiently and produce things people like prosper. So that's a kind of clear distinction. Now, are there similarities between the two? I think so. Just to take finance for a minute, which is what I've worked in for a long time. One of the curious things is that if you just take statistics on prices, for example, and you look at the way prices are changing on different timescales, so over a few minutes or over an hour or over a day, there's certain characteristic things like large fluctuations happen with a certain frequency, and there's intermittency. You have bursts of rapid activity and then periods of relative calm. And it turns out that if you do the same thing for a turbulent fluid, the weather being a great example, and you put something in the fluid that measures the velocity at a given point in space, and you move the probe, say you look at the velocity differences between two points in space, and you move the distance around, you get, first of all, the velocity of the fluid looks very much like the price series. It shows intermittency, it shows what we call heavy tails, meaning large events happen unusually often. And the way things change as you move those probes apart in space is very much like the way the statistics of the price series changes as you move the time period over which you're sampling. It's a mystery why those two things should be so much the same. But it's an example of a commonality. And actually, if you look at the theory behind it, people doing it in finance benefited a lot from the people who had done the same thing in turbulence. If I want to try and predict how hot the market's going to be tomorrow, the best way to do that has benefited from people trying to understand how turbulence is going to fluctuate and how the weather is going to fluctuate.
And yet why it's like that is, as you say, a mystery.
It's a mystery. But that's the second piece of complex systems, is a belief that complex systems in many different domains, ranging from social science to biology to physics, have things in common, and it's useful to understand those things, and one can profit by, at the very least, thinking of things in analogous terms, but maybe even more strongly, the theory I mentioned relating turbulence and finance is a quantitative theory, and the math behind the two theories is the same because, well, one was robbed from the other.
One thing that I find remarkable, and maybe you can help us understand this, is that when you look at the principle of natural selection and you look at this idea of the invisible hand, those also seem quite similar.
Yeah. I mean, you know, 50 years ago, if you said evolution, everybody would just assume you meant Darwin and biological evolution. In modern times, at least, a lot of scientists, social scientists, for example, who were interested in evolution, like me, would say, well, are you talking about biology or are you talking about culture? Because there's a lot of things in culture that obey the three basic tenets that Darwin isolated. That is, you have descent with variation and selection. So Darwin said those are the three basic principles for my theory of biological evolution. You have descent because we have inheritance. You have variation because our offspring are not exactly like us. And you have selection because the offspring that are more successful in their environment are the ones that get selected and go on to reproduce the next round. Well, the same is true in financial markets. In financial markets, you have descent in that the strategies of hedge funds, for example, are typically descended from the strategies of the people that taught the people that start the hedge funds or the hedge fund they worked at before the one they're at now. And a lot of the ideas carry over. There's variation because they do it differently, and there's selection because if they do it better, they're going to make more money and they're going to be the hedge fund that's left standing when the other ones go out of business. So it's a very similar kind of thing. The time scale is very different. A lot of the details are different. You know, the way there's no clear correspondence with genetics, but a lot of the other principles are similar. And actually, you know, I started it's not quite a hedge fund. I started something called Prediction Company in Santa Fe in 1991, and it's still operating today. It's located down kind of behind CVS and over there by the soup place. Actually, not far from the baking company.
Oh, right.
It's 2 blocks from the baking company.
Yeah, the Backstreet Bistro.
Backstreet Bistro. It's just across from the Backstreet Bistro. From my time there, looking at financial markets, I decided the most important principle for understanding what was going on was evolution. And I wrote a paper called Market Force, Ecology, and Evolution, trying to show that we can think about trading as a kind of force, and you can think about the specialization that people go through. Specialists form a kind of ecology, operating in different niches, and markets evolve through time under the selection pressure of making a profit. The time scale is a lot faster than it is in biology. I mean, markets change a lot in 5 years. But a lot of the theoretical ideas carry through, just in a somewhat different form.
So when you're looking at a complex system, one of the challenges is making a model. I mean, everybody would like to have a prediction company which can accurately predict the economy. They'd also like to be able to predict all sorts of things that are going on biologically. How do you model a complex system in a way where you can predict any events at all? Is it even possible to do so?
Yeah. Well, so it's typically possible to predict some things but not others. And in markets, for example, it's pretty hard to predict whether the price is going up or down. We had to work really hard at Prediction Company. We invested tens of millions of dollars to get to the point where we had a successful system. And it's an ongoing investment. I don't know what their budget is now. I'm no longer associated with prediction company, but you know, I'm sure their budget's $15 million a year at least. So they work very hard to do that. But they're just making not very accurate predictions about small things. In complex systems, I mean, outside of trying to make money in financial markets, we're interested in predicting broad things about the way markets behave. Why is it that volatility goes up and down? You're not necessarily going to make money from that, but it's an important thing to understand if you're interested in things like risk and financial instability and, you know, what happened in 2008, which I'm very much working on now. And so partly it's a question of what you try to predict. Like, we're working on a paper right now to try and understand how crowding works. You know, if you have more, if you have a certain number of banks and there's a universe of a certain number of assets the banks can hold, and the typical bank holds a subset of those assets, as you vary those numbers around, when are things more crowded? When is there more financial contagion? When do you have to worry about financial instabilities developing? Questions like that, that, you know, we're not going to make money on that. But if we could figure it out, it would help the government understand when we're getting into a dangerous situation.
We're talking to Don Farmer, physicist and economist. What have you come up with so far about what did happen in 2008?
Well, that's a big topic. You know, 2008, first of all, I have a talk I give on that where I have three slides with lots of bullets just throwing out all the theories that people have posited about what happened. So there's not a consensus on what happened. You know, I think we know certain elements. It was driven by a collapse of the housing bubble. The really surprising thing is that when the housing bubble collapsed, it, because mortgages were tied up in these complicated securities that lots and lots of people were invested in throughout the world, and people got incredibly nervous about what was in there, there was a huge tightening of credit, a credit freeze. And the credit freeze then leaked over into the real economy because your normal company depends on credit. Whether it's, you know, a car company depends on credit because they rely on people being able to borrow money to buy their cars, or they depend on credit because they need credit to make investments of capital goods to run their business. Lots of reasons companies use credit. And so the real economy started to freeze up. So when the real economy starts to go down the tube, people start getting laid off, which then causes another feedback loop because demand goes down and that comes back into the real economy and it affects banks. And so there's a complicated chain of events going off. Now, people debate all kinds of things. I mean, how much of it has to do with the balance of trade with the United States? Some people think that's really important. Some people think it's not so important. I mean, the U.S. is importing more than it's exporting. Is that a problem? Is it a problem that ordinary people aren't saving enough? Is it a problem that we've have been over the last 15 or 20 years turning into a society, actually longer than that, into a society where the gap between the rich and the poor has gotten much bigger? How big a role these things have played is very controversial at this point.
And the fact that that list is so long and much longer than what you've said underlines the complexity of the system and how hard it is to make a model where you put in inputs and get outputs that reflect reality.
That's very true. Though at the same time, one of the things that we're arguing is that if you want to model the economy is not just complex, it's complicated. And you have to have the key elements of that complexity in any model.
What's the difference?
Well, complicated would mean like it's got a million moving parts and it's just hard to keep track of them all. Complex might mean that it might only have 50 parts, but if they're interacting in ways that lead to subtle effects, then that can have a lot of unintended consequences and surprising behaviors.
One of the things that I think is tricky about making economic models, not that I make economic models, but I'm witnessing the difficulty in, I mean, as you say, there's a list a mile long of why a phenomenon in the past happened. So when you look at an economy like the United States or the world economy, there's so many psychological factors that play into it. And one of them is greed and lying and nefarious behavior. And those things all factor into how economies work. How do you think about those in your work?
Well, you know, those are certainly important factors, and you have to always remember people are fundamentally pretty selfish. Although people can also be extremely generous. And certainly it's a big problem when there's not transparency, when the rules are not followed. We see this very dramatically in the Greek crisis. People were just blatantly cheating on their income tax, so the whole system collapsed. But so we can put those into our models by, for example, having incentives so that, because we can simulate selection. And let me just back up a step and say we're trying to build computer models where we really try and make a simulation of the economy, and we try to make it as realistic as we can. And surprisingly, that really hasn't been done. It has to do with a culture of economics and the difference from, say, physics, where you mentioned the weather. Well, we've been trying since 1950 to make realistic simulations of the weather. We pump a lot of resources into making those simulations increasingly more realistic. But economics hasn't really gone that direction. And that's one of the new things we're trying to do.
What have they been doing?
Well, they make much more stylized models, and it's a little hard to explain, but the feeling is that the challenge of economics is that you have to model how people think. You have to have some model for how decisions get made. And if you want to model how real decisions are made, real people are complicated. There's something that economics gets called the wilderness of bounded rationality. In other words, if you want to truly, really try and model real psychology of real people, it's complicated. It's easy to get lost doing that. So what economists did, and they did it more or less in unison, is they retrenched to saying, well, let's assume people are rational. And that makes things both easier and harder. It makes it easier because in a world where everybody's rational, everybody kind of does the same thing. And actually, in simple context, you can calculate what rational behavior is. You know, the example I would use, and let me just say a lot of this is based on game theory, so a nice example might be tic-tac-toe. When I was 9 years old, it was a popular game on the playground, and it was fun at the beginning. But at some point, I remember I figured out that if you played O, you could always thwart the guy playing X so that he could never beat you. And everybody else figured that out, and we all just started drawing each other, and the game became boring. Well, what we had done is we had figured out what's called the Nash equilibrium for tic-tac-toe. We figured out the strategy that a rational person would play. So for tic-tac-toe, that's great. Chess, for example, isn't that way at all. I mean, in that, well, what's the Nash equilibrium of chess? I don't know. Nobody knows. Chess is too complicated.
Right.
I think economists settled on this idea of finding the equilibrium. You know, so in any context, they want to say, what's the equilibrium strategy that the rational player would play?
What do you mean by equilibrium strategy when you're talking about economic decisions?
Well, in economics, equilibrium it does have some of the connotation of things settling down, but it's a strategy where if you're playing the strategy, you're not going to do better by playing some other strategy. There's at least around the neighborhood of the strategy you're doing, among other roughly similar strategies, there's no way to diddle your strategy a little bit and do better.
So, example.
Example would be, well, the tic-tac-toe example I
No, but
just
I mean like
gave.
an economic decision.
Okay, so in an economic decision, I'm trying to think of a simple example. Okay, let's suppose you and I have a cake. And we want to come up with a way to divide the cake that we think is fair, that we're going to both rationally say, yep, that's fair. So what's the way to do that? One of us cuts the cake and the other one chooses which piece to take. A rational person's going to regard that as fair, and that's going to drive us to an equilibrium where the cake pieces are going to be very evenly divided. Okay, so that's the kind of equilibrium economists like to find. That's a nice trick,
Right.
right?
Now, and I can't help but think of that scene in The Godfather 2 where the old guy, the old mafioso, is dividing up his resources as they're cutting up a cake, and the cake is symbolic of this division of resources, but of course only the other mafiosi are getting them. And it kind of maps on to the world in which we live, in which resources are so unequally divided and distributed.
Yeah, which is a huge problem. And, you know, and what we're doing, that's actually also one of the very interesting questions, is why are resources distributed in the unequal way that they are? What things could we change in the economy to alter that? I mean, obviously, at one extreme, you can just tax people more. But there's more to it than that, because, for instance, this is not a completely solid fact, but during periods where the stock market does well, things get more unequal because rich people have more money in the stock market than poor people. They gain money relative to the poor. That money doesn't necessarily get passed on into wages. So if you look through time, I mean, so here's both an interesting fact and a puzzle about markets. As was noted already by Villafredo Pareto in the 19th century, if you look at the upper end of the wealth distribution, there's what's called a power law tail. So that means there's a certain characteristic distribution of wealth, so that if you ask how many people, if you say how many people have $1 million, and there's a certain number of people that have $1 million of wealth, you can ask how many people have $10 million. And the number of people that have $10 million actually drops much less than you might naively think. It drops in a very characteristic way. And so there might be, say, you know, a third as many people with $10 million. And then when you go from $10 million to $100 million, there's again a third as many. And when you go from $100 million to $1 billion, there's a third as many. So there's a very characteristic, what we would call scaling, in the tail. That is, the tail is
the far end of the bell-shaped
curve.
But it's not so bell-shaped.
It's not at all a bell-shaped curve. That was the striking thing. And we've spent a century since then trying to figure out, why is it like that? Why is it not a bell-shaped curve? But it turns out that that number I just drew out, you know, into the air, a third, varies from country to country and time to time. The distribution of wealth gets more and less concentrated in the rich, depending on which era you're in or which country you're in.
Does the other end of the scale look the same?
No, at a certain point, basically, roughly, the distinction is between wage earners and investors. So investors are, once you get into the people are making most of their money from investments, then you're out in the large tail part of the curve. Investments, I should also put a star, because there are exceptional performers, like, you know, the Beatles or rock stars or famous actors and stuff like that, that also get out of the tail.
You can call it wage earners,
right?
But they're not investors.
Right. Yeah, they're not really wage earners in the normal sense, because, you know, what they do is being amplified and broadcast to everybody.
We're talking to physicist and economist Don Farmer. One of the things about, I mean, you were talking about how economists like to model the economy in terms of people making rational decisions, but of course they don't make rational decisions. And one of the huge factors in not making rational decisions is that we're continually bombarded with advertising, which is trying to make us change decisions that we might otherwise make, and arguably trying to make us buy things that we don't really need, or to replace things that don't really need replacing. And a very large part, maybe you can tell us how much of our economy, is people buying stuff that arguably they don't really need.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly true. I'm not an expert on that at all. And it's certainly one of the many ways in which the system doesn't function the way one would like. Really, when it comes to environmental things in general, I don't think the economy's functioning very well. And I think there's a huge number of opportunities to make it function better. I think the key is to get the market incentives to interact with regulation and line them up in a way so that everybody wins.
You're talking about environmental, like pollution and climate change?
Yeah, which I think is sort of related to consuming too much junk and throwing away things we don't need to throw away, or having better incentives to make things last, recycling, all those things are tied in together. You know, left to its own devices, all the economy is going to do is maximize the profits people make. There's a lot of things called externalities that have to do with stuff that happens that's not good for everybody in general, but it might be good for a few people specifically. And
like being able to dump toxic waste into the river.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, global warming is a big externality. It's not to the advantage of coal companies to worry about global warming, but it's to the disadvantage of everybody not to worry about global warming. And so there's so many things in the economy where we have very focused special interests competing against very diffuse general interests.
Do you build, when you're looking at building an economic model that reflects reality, do you build externalities into it and see how they actually affect the economy?
Well, we can first of all observe those externalities happening, and then we can play with regulations to try and control the externalities. And one of the wonderful things about the kind of models we've been making, which are called agent-based models, they're computer simulation models in which we try and, as part of the simulation, we have the decision-making rules that agents, individuals, or institutions follow. In these models, we can build in different regulation regimes. So we can ask what happens if we change the way we're regulating putting CO2 into the atmosphere. Although actually the things we're most focused on at the time are things, because we're working hard to try and understand financial instabilities, we can play with the rules for the banking system. How much leverage should we let people use? What kind of capital requirements should banks have? Should we separate the trading parts of the banks from the client parts of the banks? All the kind of questions that are coming up in the regulatory debates we've been having and with the Dodd-Frank bill. So we can just put those things in our computer programs and see what happens.
What does agent-based mean?
So an agent is somebody who makes decisions. And so agent-based means, it's just the jargon that's emerged to say that you have a simulation that's run on a computer where you have some piece of computer code that mimics what an agent, like a person, would do. So when you were talking before about decisions about what are you going to buy versus not buy, we might have an agent that would do that. They might be deciding how much to save, how much to spend on a house versus on something else. And we try and do that, getting back to what you said about behavior, by data on what people do. So we're very pragmatic about it. We don't try and derive fancy stuff from what an economist would do is try and derive it from maximizing utility for a rational agent. You know, we just say, well, we don't know. Let's go collect data on how real people behave and build that into our simulation. And then look how that interacts with the decisions that firms are making and the decision banks are making and the financial and economic interchanges they're all making, and look at the kind of emergent behavior that's coming out when we do the simulation.
When you look at an economy, which is a very complex system with a lot of different kind of players, is there any complex system, biological system within nature that most resembles it?
Well, I don't think I could point my finger at any specific thing. I mean, people do have you know, for example, studied things like bees from an economic point of view and looked, well, the bees gathering nectar and turning it into honey and trying to make some optimize its behavior as it flies through a field of flowers. I think that I pick up the analogies a little more abstract than that, and that if you think about an ecology, there's a food chain, and the things at the bottom of the food chain are the organisms that fix sunlight, do photosynthesis, and create material with carbon that then, say, an animal might eat, like a cow or a deer or something, and then there are predators that would eat the deer in turn, and you often have a complex food web where energy flows from the bottom of the food web up. Well, the economy is kind of like that too. I mean, if you ask me in one sentence, what is an economy? I would say an economy is the process that converts natural resources into goods that we consume. And so there's a flow from the natural resources up to the consumer goods, and we're actually working on a theory where we have something like a food web where you have businesses at the bottom that are extracting the natural resources and businesses at the top of the food web that are assembling these natural resources into consumer goods, and lots of intermediate things that are building all the parts that never get consumed but eventually go into something that eventually gets consumed somewhere up the chain.
What you're saying underlines something that I think needs to be understood, that every economy at the base of it is based in nature. It's based in taking stuff out of the land or taking stuff off of the land and either selling it as is or converting it into something else and selling that. Which, if you have an economy that has to continually grow, which is what the economy that we're living in, there's a real danger to nature.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so now you're touching on very important questions about, you know, how do we make a trade-off between economic growth, which all else equal, most people like. I mean, people like to have their standard of living go up against sustainability, because we're putting a serious toll on the natural processes that provide us with ecological goods and services. And so what's going to happen? You know, the economy, the U.S. economy has been growing at between 2-3% per year ever since the Civil War. And in fact, some would argue even since the Revolution, even since it started, since we began collecting data. At the same time, we're making a bigger and bigger burden on natural processes, and we may just be hitting a wall where we just can't do any more. Now, I think that the outcome of that is subtle, and that there's another interesting thing which has been going on, which is if you look at what GDP is made of, I mean, what, you know, we produce stuff, what is that stuff? That stuff has been getting lighter. It uses less energy through time, and that is per dollar of GDP, we're using less energy to produce that dollar of GDP. Now, the problem is that that's happening slower than the growth is. That's going down a little under 1% per year. Growth is a couple of percent per year. My view is that we need to steer things to the middle. We need to get the efficiency of the economy increasing even more. And we probably have to grow less. And we have to find a point where we're in harmony so that we aren't increasing the amount of stress we're putting on ecosystems anymore. In fact, we need to take that stress back down from where we are now. But let me just wrap up. I don't think it's completely incompatible with economic growth. It's just that economic growth means something different. It means we have more services. We have more information-oriented goods that we consume that are ecologically more friendly.
We're talking to physicist and economist Don Farmer. Sustainability is such a buzzword, and you were talking about the food web, and I often wonder whether a sustainable ecosystem is a model that can map onto a sustainable economy. You've got trees that reach a certain height, and then they stop growing, but they're still very fruitful and play an important role in the ecosystem. And you've got animals milling around, and everybody's giving and taking, and the ecosystem really isn't, over a long period, really isn't changing very much. And I wonder if whether it's possible to think of economics in that way.
Well, you know, we have to realize that we've been changing ecosystems for a long time. You know, already many, it's widely believed that 10,000 years or so ago, when the first people came into North America, they wiped out all of the large mammals, the giant sloths and mastodons and so on. And that actually has a reverberating change in the ecosystem. It's not just that those animals aren't there. It changes the trees, changes the grass. And I think we increasingly have to recognize that the world is our garden. We're having a big alteration on the ecosystem. We have to take care of it. And, you maybe get a vision of it in some places in Europe where you can see that the landscape is much as it has been for a long time, though it is a landscape that's very much altered by human activity. Now, me being from New Mexico, I want to have a nice wilderness, and I miss that badly when I'm in Europe. It's pretty hard to find old-growth forest in Europe. And Europeans could do a lot better in that category. On the other hand, there is a history of trying to harmonize things and sustain them over a period of time. I think we can do it. We just have to decide that we care and that we have the societal mechanisms in place to deal with these externalities, to put pressure on the economy to satisfy the constraint of living in harmony with nature.
What I was asking, not so much whether we can live in harmony with nature, but whether a stable ecosystem, pick your ecosystem, a forest or whatever, could serve as a model for a stable economy.
Does nature have us things to tell us about how to achieve sustainability? And I very much think so. I'm increasingly convinced that ecology should really be one of the central principles in economics and finance. I think about financial markets as ecosystems where players who are performing certain basic activities like, seeking liquidity. I have an investment. I want to get some cash so I can do something. Diversifying risk. Places like prediction company are in some sense feeding on those players because those players implant predictable patterns in financial markets. Places like prediction company make investments that take advantage of those that keep the market in a certain sense in balance in other ways, much as predators do in real ecologies. And I think we have a lot to learn from understanding real ecologies and in thinking about financial and economic ecologies. The whole field is just in its infancy. And
that's what I was wondering, because I can't help but seeing these analogies between economies and nature, and I figure some of you guys have to be working on this.
Yeah. No, I wrote this paper in 1998 called Market Force Ecology and Evolution, where I really tried to develop that idea. But there's a huge amount left to be done. Maybe a slightly technical remark, there's a problem gathering the right kind of data. And this shows you the issues that you confront. In finance, for example, to really understand a financial ecology, we'd have to see who is making the trades. Because if we can't see who it is, it's a little bit like trying to just imagine you were a blind ecologist and you knew there were animals interacting, but you couldn't see whether they were foxes or rabbits. So you just knew there were some animals doing something. We really need to see who's who. And for that, we need data that has identifiers. But of course, people who are doing the trading don't want us to have those identifiers because that might give away something about their strategy or violate their confidentiality. So, we're working hard to try and get older data. I don't want to violate anybody's confidentiality or anything like that. I don't actually care too much about their strategy, but I do want to understand from an ecological point of view what's going on. And so we're trying to find situations where we do things to anonymize the data, protect everybody's confidential information, but we can still get an ecological view where we can actually see the animals interact.
I think taking anonymity in another direction, I think anonymity is, it plays a role in economics in the sense that, for example, I would never go and put poison in your drinking water, but I might invest in a company that is actually poisoning the drinking water of a community through its activities. But because I'm one or two or 10 or 100 steps of removed from that activity, I'm perfectly happy to invest in it and reap the benefits of it.
Yeah. Well, one of the key things to find this right balance between enabling private enterprise and letting the market do what it does well and controlling what the market so it doesn't do the things that it does badly is the right way to do that balance and understanding incentives. I mean, in economics, it's often called the agency problem. You have to create the right incentives for people to do the things that we as a society want people to do. We have to often also create disincentives, punishments, penalties for people doing the things they're not supposed to do. So we have rules on things like insider trading, rules about disclosure, about, say, some environmental impact. And it's critical that the information gets transmitted where it needs to be transmitted and that the rules be such to discourage unproductive activities. And we're constantly, that's something that's constantly evolving. That itself is a complex system where, you know, we're evolving the rules of government and regulation along with the market itself. Every time the market makes an innovation, we have to struggle to find the right way to regulate that innovation. And to get back to the crisis of 2008, I think it's pretty clear that one of the problems was we had a new technology in a certain sense, diversifying risk by bundling mortgages up into securities, which per se can be a good thing. It allows banks to lend at lower rates, to lend to people they couldn't lend to before. Those are good things, potentially. But if we haven't solved the agency problems about who has to deal with the shit when things get bad, then the system can go badly wrong. So we have to evolve the regulations in a way that makes the right balance so that the market can work, but bad things don't happen because it goes to extremes that it shouldn't go to.
Well, there was also a problem, and there's been some good investigative reporting on this, on something that they called reverse redlining, which was trying to get people who were in a very vulnerable economic situation into mortgages that they really couldn't afford and putting stuff on page 47 of the mortgage document that said that their payment was going to go way up in 3 years and suddenly they got a bill they couldn't afford, which nobody saw coming and which they weren't told and which was getting back to the idea of nefarious behavior. I mean, it was blatantly unethical.
Yeah, people were making money from doing that. It wasn't explicitly illegal. People hadn't fully thought it through, I would say. And that every time something new comes along, society has to have a debate of, well, do we need a law or can we just let it happen? And reasonable people disagree about this stuff. You know, it wasn't always as bad as you might think because before the crisis happened, people who wouldn't otherwise have gotten loans would get a loan at a very low teaser rate, and that 2 years there would be a balloon payment they would have to make. They would, if they made their payments for the 2 years, they would then get a good credit record. And then when the 2 year balloon payment happened, they could go renegotiate their mortgage and get a different kind of mortgage, and now they had a better credit record, and that was a good thing. The problem is, when the crisis happened, those people were stuck because they couldn't go get a better mortgage anymore because the whole system had just frozen.
Right.
And nobody thought it through that the housing bubble would, if it crashed, would generate a credit freeze that would then have all these percolating effects in the economy.
One thing that I find fascinating is that there is, for example, in philosophy, you have a new idea at a certain point in history, like the rights of individual human beings. And that eventually trickles into governments, and it trickles into the way people think about themselves. I'm a human being with rights. It's not just that I think that, it's that I come from a history where somebody thought of that and it trickled into society and now we all think that way. In economics, do you have the same thing, like economic theory then changing the way economies work and the way people think about their economies?
Oh, yes, very much so. One of the disturbing things about economists is they often come with labels of conservative or liberal, which is telling you right away that's not fully a science, because in science we think you ought to get to the same place regardless of your starting point or your ideological beliefs. And so at the state of economics now, there's a real tendency that the kind of models you make and the conclusions you reach often reflect ideological biases. Now, there's an interaction with that in society at large. There was a whole body of economic theory that, say, the University of Chicago is most closely associated with, which was very much free markets, justifying the idea that we don't need to regulate things, and so on. That's often called freshwater economics. There was a saltwater economics tradition evolving, too, that was saying, well, actually, no, wait a minute. We take this highly idealized model. We can show that if we put in a regulation, it ups everybody's welfare. Regulation's good for everybody. And then there were big fights about this stuff. And it's reverberating around the whole political debate. You know, Newt Gingrich gets up and says, this economic theory supports my idea. And Obama or someone like that might say the opposite. And so, no, that's something that as we make economics more of a science, we would hope we could get away from. The goal would be, as a scientist, I don't want to tell people what they should want. But as a social scientist, I would like to be able to tell people, if this is what you want, this is the way to get it. If you do this, this is where it's going to lead. If you do that, it's going to lead somewhere else. It's up to you to make the decision what you want.
And to be fully informed that your choices...
Make your choices in an informed way and understand the cause and effect of those choices. And so that's the goal. Ultimately, it's up to people to decide what they want.
How do you make economics more of a science?
Well, I think one has to change the culture. And in particular, ideas should rise and fall based on their empirical success. If something works and you're able to show that your ideas are correctly predicting and describing the world, then those are good ideas that should gain more resources, more study, more positions in leading universities. If you're not able to do that, then you should stop doing what you're doing. Economics suffers from... all science ultimately has a subjective element. But in physics, it's a lot easier to agree. You know, people get in arguments about stuff, but they tend to get resolved because there's a protocol for doing experiments to resolve them. You can't just do experiments in economics. Experiments tend to be very expensive because, you know, the government does an experiment and we pay a big price because it doesn't work and it's very slow and so on. Nonetheless, you know, as we gather more and more data, as economics becomes more and more empirical, I think we can do a better and better job than the current situation, which I think is much too much self-reinforcing ideas. I learned this, so that's what I'm going to teach my students. They learn the same tricks I knew, and therefore we have a vested interest in doing things that way.
Doan Farmer is a physicist. He's a professor in the Institute of New Economic Thinking at Oxford and director of the Complexity Economics Center there. And he's external faculty at the Santa Fe Institute. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been my pleasure.